It's not an art. It's not something big to evade the punishment of the hereafter. That's not what we're here for. Not going to the hellfire is not something hard. It's easy. Allah's mercy is too great. Allah will forgive with the slightest excuse. What's hard is to gain higher levels of closeness to Him. So this isn't something that we should actually ask for. A person who dies young didn't have the chance to develop. Of course, it doesn't mean that he's going to be in a bad position on that day, but he won't benefit from all the good stuff either.
One cannot wait to see the wonders we are promised in the world of Barzakh, a world which takes us one step further to our final destination, meeting with the Lord. A world which empowers us to an extent unimaginable for us in this life. However, we have not exhausted all our topics about the fascinations of the world of Barzakh. Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk about those topics. Until then, peace be with you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we spoke on Saddam's invasion to Iran at the behest of his masters in Washington and also discussed Imam Khomeini's reaction to this. Today we are going to dwell upon the election of Abul Hassan Bani Sadr as the first president of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the events leading to his dismissal. Stay tuned, please. Nearly 8 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution and 70 sessions of the Assembly of Experts, the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran was prepared and finally was ratified by the Iranian nation in a referendum in December 1979. A few days later, the enrollment for the candidates of presidential election started and 8 candidates were introduced to the people to run for the election. The elections were held in a fervent atmosphere, and Abul Hassan Bani Sadr garnered 75% of the votes, nearly 11 million votes, and was elected as the first president of the new Islamic system. Then, in early February 1980, he took oath of loyalty to the constitution at the presence of Imam Khomeini and some of the officials, and Imam endorsed his presidency. Then Imam Khomeini, in a short speech, advised Bani Sadr to take care of his morals after being elected as president. Bani Sadr had to introduce his cabinet members to the parliament, but this was delayed due for a few months, as the parliament had not been formed yet. Finally, in July 1980, he took oath in front of the lawmakers as the president of Iran and said that he would soon introduce his premier for appointment of ministers. Bani Sadr introduced a few figures whom were rejected due to certain reasons. Then a council was held to solve the differences between the president and the parliament. And finally, Muhammad Ali Rajai was introduced as the prime minister, although Bani Sadr was at odds with Rajai, owing to the latter's full obedience of Imam Khomeini. The differences between Bani Sadr and Rajai lingered, and these differences culminated in introduction of the cabinet members as, according to the constitution, it was the prime minister who would do the job and then the president would approve them to be introduced to the parliament for the vote of trust. Muhammad Ali Rajai consulted with the prominent figures of the Islamic Revolution and at last determined the list for the cabinet. However, the list was rejected by the president as he emphasized on compliance with the president as the criterion for choosing of cabinet members. But the imam stressed mutual comprehension, which led to the reduction of tension, and the cabinet was finally held. Nevertheless, the differences between the prime minister and the president increased day by day, and they spread to other areas, such as the authority of the president in decision over the fate of the American hostages, the administration of the war, and other issues. During this tense climate in the country, a commission was held to act as the arbiter between the president and the premier. The commission had a representative from Imam Khomeini too, but Bani Sadr would not accept the decision of the commission, although he had a representative in it. Due to betrayal and malfeasance in the war and various issues, Bani Sadr was introduced as guilty, and then Imam Khomeini dismissed him as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, though he stressed that Bani Sadr had to continue his presidential responsibilities. During those tough conditions, the parliament, after lengthy debates, voted for the political disqualification of Bani Sadr, in which 170 MPs voted in favor of the bill. As a result, Bani Sadr was deposed of presidency. Thus, he tried to draw his fans to the streets, but Imam Khomeini's harsh stance against him and his supporters in his party nipped his efforts in the bud. Therefore, Bani Sadr was ousted from presidency, and a few days later, he escaped from the country. He was accompanied by the criminal ringleader of the MKO terrorist outfit, Masoud Rajavi. Both of them were disguised as women, not to be recognized.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo Jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Security services, the fake Israeli regime, and certain Western politicians that have engineered plots to spark a civil war, destroy and break up Iran, must know that Iran is neither Libya nor Sudan. That was what Iran's foreign minister tweeted recently. Abdullahian said that Iran's enemies have their eyes set on Iran's territorial integrity and identity, accusing Israel and Western intelligence services of plotting to start civil war in the Islamic Republic. The statements were confirmed by a leaked audio from a presenter at UK's state-funded news channel, BBC Persian. Abdullahian had good reason to relay those sentiments. The statements came on the heels of a number of terrorist attacks in the Islamic Republic. One took place in Izeh, in the southwestern province of Khuzestan, killing seven people, including a nine-year-old boy and woman. The other took place in Isfahan, in which terrorists attacked security forces and killed three of them. There's a vicious anti-Iran media campaign led by terrorist media outlets like the Saudi-funded Iran International, which are twisting the truth and are accusing Iranian security forces of committing the terrorist acts. This stage of the anti-Iran plot is called an armed one, something that the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton warned about. He claimed that subversive elements in Iran, which he dubbed as the opposition, were arming themselves with weapons stolen from besieged forces and smuggled from Iraq's Kurdistan. This was evident when an uptick in the number of security forces killed were reported during 3 days, from November 15th through November 18th. During this period, 14 security forces were reported to have been victims of terrorist attacks. The terrorist killings in Izeh, Isfahan, and Mashhad, which followed a recent similar attack against pilgrims and worshippers at the shrine of Shah Charagh in Shiraz, also showed that the enemy plots have failed, and they are now subscribing to terrorist acts involving firearms and weapons. Iran has blasted the silence of the international community over the recent terrorist attacks. It blamed foreign powers for promoting and encouraging violence and terrorism. Further said that their silence is testament to that, saying undoubtedly the international silence of claimants of human rights and foreign promoters of chaos and violence in Iran in the face of the most blatant terrorist operations in a number of Iranian cities conveys no other message than encouragement of terrorism and the promotion of terrorism across the world. The Iranian city of Mashhad. Funeral processions were held for three besieged volunteer force members who were stabbed to death by rioters earlier this week. The turnout in the tens of thousands. The Iran's leader has stated that they are trying to give the impression that large numbers of people are opposed to the Islamic establishment in order to impress ignorant individuals. However, the leader noted that the people's mass presence on stage to safeguard the Islamic revolution amounts to a slap in the face of ill-wishers. That became even more evident when the following day in Isfahan, again, people showed up in large numbers, tens of thousands, to pay their last respects to the victims while condemning all acts of violence and terror. Putting these scenes next to each other, there is no comparison. The Saudi-funded Iran International depiction of what is happening in Iran is far from reality, to the point that the channel, which Iran has named a terrorist entity, is actively promoting and encouraging not only acts of violence, but is under the delusional impression that there is a revolution underway in Iran. The scenes, when put next to each other, speak for themselves.
For weeks, Iran has witnessed unrest and riots in its different cities. The unrest started after a young woman named Mahsa Amini fainted in police custody and later died in hospital. The protests were initially peaceful, but violent elements supported by Western spy agencies hijacked the protests and turned into violent riots. The unrest has provided the fertile ground for Western governments and spy agencies to launch a media warfare on Iran and create anti-Iran fake news. A recent notorious case in point is the recent tweet by Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. In the controversial tweet, the Canadian Premier had claimed that Iran has sentenced 15,000 protesters to death. The false claim, which has been part of the media campaign against Iran, has been circulating on social media in recent days. The inaccurate tweet was live on Trudeau's official Twitter account for almost 12 hours before it was deleted. Several Western celebrities and news outlets, including the Newsweek, also shared the erroneous information. This is not the only case of false news propagated against Iran. When the protests first started in Iran, Western-backed propaganda outlets claimed that Mahsa Amini was beaten to death by Iranian police forces. Following an elaborate investigation, that claim also proved to be false. It's now become a common practice for these propaganda machines to publish unverified footages on protests in Iran. Back in September 2022, U.S. media outlets ran a controversial report. The report was widely discussed and celebrated in anti-Iran outlets. But it turned out to be a fake report after Ayatollah Khamenei publicly attended a military ceremony in Tehran in October. The false report was propagated by Western outlets as Iran was battling the Western-backed riots. Social media platforms have also turned into a battleground of narratives against Iran. Analysis shows those tweeting the hashtags associated with the unrest showed a striking number of new accounts created since the protests started.
In August 2011, when there were riots in London because someone was shot and killed by the police, a number of people were killed. I don't recall the exact number. But big tech, Facebook, back then BlackBerry, and Twitter cooperated with the British government. In the case of Iran, big tech is used as a weapon against Iranians. So Iranian voices don't come out. Iranians lose their, if they are opposed to the Western narrative, they get sanctioned. All of the Iranian media is sanctioned. Many individuals have lost their accounts. I have lost my Facebook and Instagram accounts. So these Western big tech companies, they cooperate with Western governments, even though in the riots in London, people were killed, and they arrested people and put them in jail for inciting riots. But in Iran, these same media outlets make threats, they support, they help people make Molotov cocktails, and they help mobilize the rioters.
The online anti-Iran campaign is fed by fake accounts used by members of the anti-Iran Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization terrorist cult who are stationed in Albania and so-called journalists employed by the Saudi-funded London-based Iran International TV, which is now on Tehran's terror blacklist. The television channel has openly been promoting monarchists, the highly notorious MKO terror group, and most significantly, separatist terrorists. A particular case in point is a project by Western media outlets to accuse the government of killing its own citizens. They have produced a long list of citizens which they claim have been killed by security forces.
Iran has witnessed another deadly terrorist attack. The latest deadly incident happened in the city of Izeh in Iran's southwestern province of Khuzestan. Unidentified gunmen opened fire on civilians and security forces, killing several people, including a child and an elderly woman. The terror attack also left a number of people injured. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the assault. President Ebrahim Raisi has condoled with the families of the victims, ordering security officials to identify and bring to justice all terrorists behind the attack. A senior judicial official says three people who were behind the brutal attack were arrested. A special operation is going on to identify and to bring to justice other people involved in the attack in the city of Izeh. Separately, a religious seminary school in the Izeh city was set ablaze by a group of rioters. No one was injured in that incident. Separately, three people were killed and eight security forces injured during riots in Semirom in the central Iranian province of Isfahan. Two security forces also killed and two others wounded in the city of Malikshahr in Isfahan province. Last month, a terrorist attack happened in the city of Shiraz. On October 26, a terrorist attacked the popular Shia shrine of Shah Cheragh in Iran's southwestern province of Fars, killing over a dozen people. That attack was claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. The attacks come amid ongoing foreign-backed riots that have hit various Iranian provinces after a 22-year-old Kurdish woman named Mahsa Amini died in the hospital despite intensive medical care and resuscitation efforts. The rioters have been going on a rampage across the country, attacking security officers, resorting to vandalism against public property, and desecrating religious sanctities. Iran says the attacks are part of a larger plot to destabilize the country. Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian says security services, the Israeli regime, and certain Western politicians are conspiring to trigger a civil war in Iran to destroy and to disintegrate the country. He warned them that Iran is not Libya or Sudan. He also noted that the enemies are targeting Iran's territorial integrity and identity, saying that Iran will not allow anyone to jeopardize national security. The terrorist attack comes amid Western attempts to stoke unrest in Iran and to create more economic hardships for the Iranian people. Late last month, Iran's main intelligence bodies reported that the U.S., backed by the U.K., Saudi Arabia, Israel, and other allies, are devising a multidimensional plot for instigating riots in the Islamic Republic and directing the wave of violence.
We are telling our enemies, the U.S., Britain, the Saudis, these are the ones that, through their destructive media outlets, they are targeting our revolution. We are warning them that we will break you, we will crush you, you will not find any way into this territory.
Western countries expressed their open support for rioters and acts that Tehran described as inciting violence and hatred. The European Union and some Western countries have imposed sanctions on Iran over its approach toward the recent riots. Recently, the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton confirmed that subversive groups in Iran, which he characterized as the opposition, are being armed with weapons imported from Iraq's Kurdistan.
United States should take history as a mirror and let it guide the future. That's what the Chinese President Xi Jinping told his American counterpart Joe Biden on the sidelines of the Group of 20 summit in Bali, Indonesia.
As always, I'm ready to have a candid and in-depth exchange of views with Mr. President on issues of strategic importance in China-US relations and major global and regional issues at our meeting today. I also look forward to working with you to bring China-U.S. relations back to the track of healthy and stable development.
We share a responsibility, in my view, to show that China and the United States can manage our differences, prevent competition from becoming anything ever near conflict, and to find ways to work together on urgent global issues that require our mutual cooperation.
The two held their first ever in-person meeting as relations between Washington and Beijing are at their lowest in decades, marred by disagreements over a host of issues from Taiwan to trade. During the landmark three-hour meeting, the Chinese president warned his U.S. counterpart not to cross Beijing's red line over Taiwan. According to the Chinese state media, Xi stressed that Taiwan is the bedrock of the political foundation of bilateral relations. Biden, for his part, said the U.S. wants to manage differences with China to prevent competition from becoming conflict. Biden said he sought to assure Xi that U.S. policy on Taiwan has not changed, seeking to lower tensions over the self-ruled island.
And I do not think there's any imminent attempt on the part of China to invade Taiwan. And I made it clear that our policy on Taiwan has not changed at all. It's the same exact position we've had. I made it clear that we want to see cross-strait issues peacefully resolved.
On North Korea, Biden told Xi that Beijing has an obligation to attempt to talk Pyongyang out of conducting a seventh nuclear test. U.S.-China relations have been strained in recent years by growing tensions over issues ranging from Taiwan to the South China Sea, trade practices, and U.S. restrictions on Chinese technology. Regarding Taiwan, Beijing says it's a matter for the Chinese and China's internal affair. Anyone that seeks to split Taiwan from China will be violating the fundamental interests of the Chinese nation. Tensions over the self-ruled island have intensified following a provocative visit there in August by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The move prompted large-scale Chinese military drills around the island territory, as well as a declaration by the U.S. President Joe Biden to defend Taiwan. Beijing has time and again slammed U.S. provocations, including encouraging and supporting pro-separatist independence forces on the island, saying that Washington has no right to interfere in how to resolve the Taiwan issue. Also, Biden dropped the hammer on China's semiconductor industry by fully implementing a slew of tough controls on the export of American chip technology to China. It would also undermine China's ability to import, manufacture, and export the semiconductors that run the world. The goal was to slow down and prevent Chinese military and technological advances. Washington also takes sides with Beijing's rivals in a maritime dispute in the South China Sea, by routinely sending warships and warplanes to the waters to assert what it calls its right to freedom of navigation. China has repeatedly called on Washington to stop the provocative actions, which undermine peace and stability in the strategic waters. Last month, the White House and the Pentagon declared Beijing as Washington's most serious strategic competitor, in reports outlining U.S. defense and foreign policy strategies. Therefore, despite Biden's meeting with Xi, can the two manage their differences to prevent conflict? Or is it inevitable that the two are on the collision course?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Experts say the United States remains the number one arms exporting nation on the planet. This country likes tension in the world because it feeds on the tension. By stoking tension between countries and regions around the world and selling arms to the conflicting parts, The U.S. regime fills the pockets of the military-industrial complex. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The website of Truth Out noted, while the humanitarian consequences of U.S. arms sales may be devastating, if you happen to be a major weapons maker like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, or General Dynamics, the economic benefits are enormous. Weapon systems built by those four companies alone have figured in more than half of the $100 billion-plus dollars in major arms offers made since President Biden took office. While those firms prefer to pose as passive beneficiaries of carefully considered government policies, they continue to work overtime to loosen restrictions on weapons exports and expand the number of countries eligible for such equipment and training. To that end, those four giant firms alone routinely donate millions of dollars to key members of Congress while employing 300 lobbyists, many of them drawn from the ranks of the Pentagon, Congress, and the National Security Council. Once on board, those retired generals, admirals, and other officials use their government contacts and inside knowledge of the arms sales process to influence government policies and practices. Particularly egregious and visible example of this was Raytheon's effort to pressure Congress and the Trump administration to approve a sale of precision-guided munitions to the Saudis. A former Raytheon lobbyist, Charles Faulkner, worked inside the State Department to keep the Saudi arm pipeline open despite that country's bombing of civilian targets in Yemen, and then Raytheon's former CEO, Thomas Kennedy, even went so far as to directly lobby Senate Foreign Relations Chairman Senator Rob Menendez over Saudi arms sales. He was rebuffed. But the most spectacular lobbyist for the Saudi was, of course, Trump, who justified continuing arms sales to Riyadh after the regime's 2018 murder of U.S. resident, Saudi journalist, and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi this way. $110 billion will be spent on the purchase of military equipment from Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and many other great U.S. defense contractors. If we foolishly cancel these contracts, Russia and China would be enormous beneficiaries and very happy to acquire all this newfound business. It would be a wonderful gift to them directly from the United States, he said. In fact, neither Russia nor China would be able to replace the U.S. as Saudi Arabia's primary arms supplier anytime soon. The kingdom is so reliant on American equipment that it might take a decade or more for it to rebuild its military around weapons supplied by another nation. In reality, expensive as American arms sales to the Saudi are, that $110 billion figure was a typical case of Trumpian exaggeration. Actual sales during his term were less than one-third of that, and jobs tied to those sales in the U.S. were similarly far less than President Trump claimed. The figure he liked to throw around, 500,000, was at least 12 times the actual one. Still, the damage done by the weaponry his administration rammed through Congress for the Saudis has been incalculable and can't be measured by the dollar value of any particular sale. The Raytheon lobbying campaign was extraordinary primarily because its details became public knowledge, but count on one thing. Similar efforts by other military-industrial corporations surely take place behind closed doors on a regular basis. One precondition for reducing dangerous arms deals would have to be reducing the political power of the major weapons-producing companies. Also, responsible statecraft wrote, U.S. military forces have been engaged in unauthorized hostilities in many more countries than the Pentagon has disclosed to Congress, let alone the public, according to a major new report released late last week by New York University School of Law's Brennan Center for Justice. Afghanistan, Iraq, maybe Libya. If you ask the average American where the United States has been at war in the past 2 decades, you would likely get this short list, according to the report. Secret war, how the U.S. uses partnerships and proxy forces to wage war under the radar. But this list is wrong, off by at least 17 countries in which the United States has engaged in armed conflict through ground forces, proxy forces, or airstrikes. The report's author Catherine Yon Ebright wrote in the introduction, this proliferation of secret war is a relatively recent phenomenon, and it is undemocratic and very dangerous. The conduct of undisclosed hostilities in unreported countries contravenes our constitutional design. It invites military escalation that is unforeseeable to the public, to Congress, and even to the diplomats charged with managing U.S. foreign relations.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. They did whatever they were capable of doing. They supported separatist groups at the beginning of the revolution. They supported the coup d'etat attempt at the Nongje military base in Hamadan. The Americans showed support for the blind terrorism of the Munafiqeen, MKO, which led to the killing of thousands of martyrs across the country. They supported savage Saddam Hussein during Iraq's imposed war on Iran. They provided him with weapons, intelligence, information, and aid. They made the Arabs pay money. There is some information about this, which I am not completely certain about, but apparently it is reliable information that even the start of the war was provoked by the Americans, and they were the ones who forced Saddam to initiate the 8-year war. They, the Americans, shut down an Iranian passenger airplane in the skies of the Persian Gulf, which resulted in the death of over 300 people, and they did not express any regret afterward. They even rewarded that criminal general who shot down the plane. They honored him with a medal. This is how you have treated the Iranian people.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You imposed sanctions on the Iranian nation since the first year of the revolution. You imposed the most severe sanctions that history has ever witnessed in the last few years. They said this themselves, as well as their support for unrest and sedition in Iran. You clearly supported these seditions during the sedition that took place in 2009. Prior to that, Obama wrote to me saying that we want to cooperate with you. We are your friends. He was, in a sense, swearing that they did not wish to overthrow us. However, as soon as the sedition of 2009 began, they started to support it in the hope that the sedition might go somewhere and bring the Iranian nation to its knees and overthrow the Islamic Revolution. This is how you treated the Iranian nation.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The narrow success of the Republicans in the congressional elections and taking over the House of Representatives has become a matter of concern for Ukrainians because it can weaken Washington's financial and military support for Kiev. The Biden administration is trying to show itself committed to supporting Ukraine in the war with Russia, but the majority of Republicans and even some Democrats are against more aid to Kiev and are demanding more attention to America's internal problems. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Taipei Times has covered this story. U.S. Republican lawmakers on Thursday, 17th of November, vowed to give more scrutiny to financial support for Kiev once they take control of the U.S. House of Representatives in January, risking a showdown with the administration of President Joe Biden and raising questions about the long-term U.S. commitment as the war in Ukraine drags on. U.S. Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, Thomas Massey of Kentucky, and other proponents of cutting aid to Ukraine demanded at a news conference that an inspector general be appointed to examine how money for Ukraine has been spent so far, saying Americans would not continue to support Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky without asking tough questions. Representative Thomas Massey of Kentucky said, "It's high time to stop sending any more money. Don't send another penny to Ukraine." U.S. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene said, "The U.S. could have secured its border with Mexico using the money sent to Ukraine." While Greene and Massey are unlikely to get their wish to halt all funding to Ukraine, such demands could add to pressure on Republican leaders and create headaches for the Biden administration, which has put a focus on unity among Western allies to keep money and weaponry flowing to Zelensky's military. Joe Biden asked Congress recently for $37.7 billion in new aid to Ukraine, and Democrats are expected to try to supply that in a $1.7 trillion annual funding bill next month. While President Biden should have some ways to work around recalcitrant lawmakers after Republicans take over the House this January, their demands are certain to make allies uneasy. U.S. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who is set to become Speaker of the House, said recently that Republicans are not going to write a blank check for Ukraine, especially given rising inflation at home in the United States. The U.S. has contributed about $18 billion in security assistance and weaponry since Russia started its special operation in Ukraine last February. However, the Republican victory was narrow in the midterm elections, and some in the party want to keep the aid flowing to Ukraine, giving Democrats some leverage. Republicans on Joe Biden's side include Representative Michael McCaul, who is set to take control of the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee. U.S. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has said his party wants to send Ukraine more assistance and not less. However, qualms about the scale of support for Ukraine also might resurface from the left of the Democratic Party. In October, a letter from a group of 30 progressive House Democrats urged Joe Biden to pursue negotiations with Russia to bring about a diplomatic end to the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Within hours after criticism from other Democrats, they backpedaled and affirmed support for Joe Biden's strategy. Meanwhile, the website of TheHill.com has also covered the same story. The Hill reports Republican U.S. Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida has also spoken out against Washington's funding of Ukraine's war effort against Russia, insisting that the days of endless financial and security aid for Ukraine are numbered, following his party's midterm election victory that turns over the control of the House of Representatives to the Republicans in January of 2023. Matt Gaetz declared on Thursday, 17th of November, he said, "I'm here as a member of the House Armed Services Committee to say that the days of endless cash and military assistance to Ukraine are numbered." He added, "They're numbered in the days that are required to act on Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene's well-thought-out resolution of inquiry, and they are numbered when we get into the majority." Vowing not to vote for one more dollar or more piece of military equipment for Ukraine, the far-right lawmaker further insisted that the United States is far too entangled in the Ukraine conflict and has effectively extended it. Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida also demanded from U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin to declassify the Inspector General's report on compliance with the existing regulations regarding the chain of custody of material going to Ukraine. This is why Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene announced on Thursday, 17th of November, that she is introducing legislation alongside other Republican representatives to to audit the military funding of the Ukraine war. Marjorie Taylor Greene said, "We are asking for everything to do with military, civilian and financial aid. We want it all." Marjorie Taylor Greene further underlined that if the resolution is struck down, she intends to reintroduce the measure in January after the Republicans take control of the lower chamber of the U.S. Congress. She said, "For next year, absolutely, I'll introduce this resolution again, but I'll also be calling for a full audit. That's what we want. We want to audit Ukraine." Co-sponsors of the legislation include Republican Representatives Matt Gaetz of Florida, Barry Moore of Alabama, Andrew Clyde of Georgia, Thomas Macy of Kentucky, and Representative-elect Corey Mills of Florida also appear alongside the lawmakers at a Thursday press conference. Fox News Channel has also covered the same story. Former Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard has blasted U.S. President Joe Biden, the Washington elite, and the U.S. military-industrial complex, blaming them for hiring an army of Internal Revenue Service agents to crack down on American taxpayers while using their money to fund the Ukrainian army with billions of U.S. dollars. Tulsi Gabbard said on Friday, 18th of November, "We have politicians from both political parties who are the permanent Washington elite and who must be held accountable for what they're doing with our taxpayer dollars and how they're undermining our national security as they push us closer and closer to the brink of nuclear catastrophe." Insisting that Washington should stop giving a blank check to Ukraine and demand accountability for the tens of billions of dollars in military aid already provided for Kiev, Tulsi Gabbard further underlined that much of this huge amount of money has gone to the U.S. military-industrial complex, which has already profited trillions of dollars from U.S.-sponsored wars abroad. Former Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard said, "Now the Biden administration wants to hire 87,000 new Internal Revenue Service agents to go over every receipt and every deductible of American taxpayers with a fine-tooth comb, squeezing every penny that they can," pointing out that for the Ukrainian government and their corrupt bureaucrats and oligarchs and the defense contractors who are profiting from all these weapons, the Biden administration requires no receipts at all. The politician turned commentator and a veteran of the U.S.-led military invasion of Iraq further complained that as Washington continues to commit funds and troops to conflicts abroad, the White House and Congress are failing in their duty to care for America's war veterans.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
People turned out in the city of Isfahan to bid farewell to three security forces who lost their lives in the street violence gripping several Iranian cities in recent weeks. The mourners condemned the killings, urging authorities to bring the perpetrators to justice.
"This funeral sends the message to the well-wishers of the country that we support our security forces. The security of our country matters and will not allow anyone to undermine it.
I urge the authorities to bring those behind the incident to justice.
So today, we gathered here to thank the security forces who are trying to protect us against chaos and instability.
The incident took place in north of Isfahan on November 16th, when two armed men on a motorbike opened fire at the security forces, killing one law enforcement officer and two members of the volunteer Basij force. It happened amid clashes between police and rioters. The intelligence service of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has identified and arrested those behind the incident.
It's clear who is inciting the turmoil in the country. The US, UK, and Saudi Arabia are behind the evil plan to divide our nation. But we are here to tell them that their plot will fail.
Iran says the unrest is a plot hatched by the West, particularly the US.
People here say they will not tolerate any harm to their country's national security. They called for an end to riots, saying the continuation of the unrest will only serve the interests of Iran's enemies. Yusuf Jalali, Isfahan.
Mariana Vyshemersky. In March this year, she found herself at the center of a propaganda war between Russia and the West. Photo of her while pregnant at a maternity hospital in Mariupol went viral. Ukraine alleged that the hospital was hit by a Russian airstrike. Photos used to stir horror around the world at Russia's alleged actions.
They asked me for an interview. I answered that I didn't want to be interviewed, but they explained that the photo with me was all over the world, so I had to give them some comments. But as I got to know later, they published only 30 seconds of that interview. They left only the piece where I was saying that there was an explosion and the windows fell out. But they left out my words where I said there was no airstrike.
Many Russians then accused her of being a staged actor. She wasn't. The photos were genuine and she received abuse from the Russian side. But she is more critical of the journalists who she said misrepresented her. And to me, she voiced no criticism of the Russian army, instead only criticizing Ukraine. Mariana is from Makiivka in Donbass. She lived there until 2019 under Ukrainian shelling. She's now moved back with her daughter. She is a Russian citizen.
There are hardly any people left here waiting for Ukraine to return. There might have been more before, but as the civil population has been under constant shelling and been terrorized for almost 9 years, my personal opinion is, if they consider these territories to be theirs, they can gather their army and try to conquer them. If they can't, well, so be it. Under shelling, there have been hardly any military objects hit. Instead, civilian infrastructure damaged, schools and kindergartens.
Mariana's story is reminiscent of the famous picture of Omran during the conflict in Syria. His photo was used to stir outrage in the West against the Syrian government. It turned out that his family were not against the Syrian government. As the propaganda war between East and West increasingly intensifies, the images of innocent civilians are being used to stir outrage. Pictures, as they say, speak a thousand words. It is likely only a matter of time before another such image goes viral that turns out to not be all as it seems. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
In the 2020 presidential election campaign, Joe Biden made a full return to the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program, a key plank of his foreign policy promises. After 2 years in office, his report card on keeping that promise can only be given a failing grade. Not only has Biden not returned to the JCPOA, but he has constantly levied new sanctions on Iran and seems to have fully retained the maximum pressure policy of his predecessor.
For 2 years now, Biden and, you know, his team of foreign policy ghouls like Tony Blinken have refused to lift the illegal sanctions dating back to the Trump era. Trump illegally withdrew from the JCPOA, and they're refusing to lift those sanctions, which has made any negotiations with Iran impossible.
Biden had benefited from total control over Congress, but the Democratic Party lost control of the House of Representatives in the recent midterm elections. Low turnout and disillusionment with many unkept promises are often being cited as the main reasons for the Democrats' defeat. Last month, a top poll on foreign policy found that a whopping 79% of Americans want the United States to continue to pursue negotiations with Iran.
On almost no other key foreign policy question was there such massive support.
With Congress now divided and more conservative, most analysts say that even if Biden did genuinely